So I went up and back. Good evening. I went up and back as to whether, you know, we've done on average two classes per letter. We had very few letters that we've done only one class. We've had a few letters that we've done multiple classes on. And I was very torn what to do. Last week, we covered the letter Lamed, the 12th letter of the alphabet. And there really is a lot more to say, but I have chosen not to. I have chosen to move forward. And we're going to explore the 13th letter, the letter Mem. Now, let's start with the starting point. First of all, I guess we should really see what does the letter look like. So it's here somewhere. Share screen. There we go. Okay. So everybody sees the screen here. What's fascinating is that this is the first time that I have made mention of the fact that there are two forms of the letter. Here is the classic mem, right here, right in the middle of this line. That's your classic mem. But right next to it is the other mem. They're both called mem. What's the difference? So the one in green is the letter mem that is used whenever it is used in a word. That letter is used in a word unless it's the final letter. In the final letter form, it will appear as the pink letter. But they're both called mem. Now, the truth of the matter is that this is not the first letter that has a double form. We actually had it, not the previous letter, Lamed, but the one before it, the letter Kaf. There are two forms. Again, you have the regular form that's used everywhere in a word, except when it's in the last position, in which case you use this one, both called Kaf or Chaf. But I don't have an answer to a question that bothered me. And that is, I chose to ignore this final Chaf because I said we're going to deal with final letters at the very end. But the Talmud disagreed with me. What can I say? It's not the first time. The Talmud didn't focus at all on the final Kaf. But when it comes to the letter Mem, it actually makes a big deal. And it just as we've gone through each piece of the Talmud. The Talmud, when it gets to its discussion about the letter Mem, it refers to it as Mem Petucha, an open Mem, because you can see here at the bottom left, it's open. You see that? As opposed to the Mem Stuma, the closed Mem, where it is completely closed on all four sides. The Talmud identifies, and when it discusses the letter Mem, it brings up both of them, which it did not do in the previous when we got to Kaf. I don't have an answer yet why that is. But for tonight, because we're focusing on the letter Mem, we are forced to deal with it. Because as the Talmud says, to understand the essence of the letter Mem, you need to understand it in the context of both a regular normative Mem and the final mem. Okay? So just bear that in mind. We will come back to this chart again. But what's up with these letters? What's up with these mem, open letter and closed letter? So the Talmud says what it stands for as follows. The mem stands for the word ma'amar. Ma'amar means statement, like the word omer, like one of the most famous words in the Torah, Vayomer Hashem, or Vayomer Moshe, and Hashem spoke, and God said, or Moses said. The word, the letter Mem, the Talmud differentiates between a Ma'amar Petucha, an open expression, versus a Ma'amar Satum, a closed expression. What does that mean? Opened expressions and closed expressions. So I guess the easiest way to explain this is that there are some people, well, we'll get there, Jay. Hang in there. Jay's already writing me notes there, and they're not love notes, so hang on. We'll get there. The easiest way, I think, to explain this is that you meet some people, and they're very articulate. You know exactly what they're saying. They're very clear. And then there are other people. I feel like I'm going through mental gymnastics. I have to like think, this is what they said, but is this really what they mean? And why do they, it's very cryptic. Well, the Talmud understands that that is true, not just in human terms, but in godly terms as well. There are certain subject matter that can be taught and discussed openly. There's no problem classifying. There's no problem getting into the nitty-gritty of that conversation or that discussion of something related to Judaism or something related to God and philosophy. But there are other subjects that are, in its very nature, very esoteric. They're really, I don't want to use the word deep, because I think everybody has a level of intelligence to understand depth when it's explained properly. But there are certain concepts that are just very esoteric, difficult to wrap your head around. Well, the Talmud tells us that that is in fact true. Subjects that can be taught and discussed openly, for example, anything that's associated with aspects of human life, what it is about human nature, what it is we're supposed to do, or what it is we're supposed to be contemplating, those are the things that can definitely be discussed openly without any issues whatsoever. However, there are certain secrets of the Torah, certain aspects of Judaism or godliness or God's interaction with the world that are much more esoteric and really lend themselves to be easily confused, and a person can be easily misled. The Talmud is telling us that when it talks about this letter mem, there are ma'amarot, there are statements, there are expressions, there are philosophical concepts. Certain ones are open and certain ones are more closed. It's not an open book for everything, for everyone, for all time. The classic example that I think everybody here is familiar with is the concept of the study of mysticism, Kabbalah. Well, whether you know it, you don't know it, you've heard the concept, it's clearly not something that you teach second and third graders, because it is way above, there's no way they don't have the capability to truly understand. Why? Not that they're dumb. They just, they're not, their minds are not mature enough to comprehend the concepts. Well, the truth of the matter is that there are certain concepts that even as adults, that we are really hard pressed to really try to comprehend and understand. Kabbalah is a great example. You know, I'm sure you've all heard the expression, one should not study Kabbalah till age 40. You've heard this expression, don't study Kabbalah until age 40. Well, hopefully by the time we're done with this letter, you will understand and appreciate what that really means. Okay? By the way, just put it on the back burner, the letter mem that we're discussing is what numerical value? Right, 40. Very good. Excellent. You'll make a note of it. Okay. So the Talmud is telling us that there are certain concepts in Judaism that are open and certain ones that are closed. And that is the form of the two letters, again, of the mem, where you have one that is open, one that remains, that has an open part, and one that is completely closed. Okay? So let's try to understand this a little more. You know, even those individuals who have mastered the Torah, who have mastered pretty much everything there is in terms of understanding, and they can even be qualified to study Kabbalah, this is a warning. This is a warning to proceed with great caution. And the Talmud tells us about the famous story about four incredible, incredible sages who entered Pardes. For those of you who've ever taken a course, they have an institute, the Pardes Institute. Do you ever wonder why they call it that? Pardes literally means orchard, a garden, an orchard. Why? Well, does anybody know why? What the word Pardes is alluding to?
Is it alluding to the Garden of Eden?
Nope. I mean, you can connect it to that, but it's much more than that. Because
I
what it is
don't
as
know the
follows.
answer.
It stands for four words. The word pardes is spelled with the letter pei, then resh, then dalid, then samach. And it stands for pshat. I'm sorry?
Paradise, the four levels of Torah.
Okay, so what does that mean? It means pshat. The pei stands for pshat, which means regular understanding. Simple, what is the story telling us? What is the Torah teaching us? Basic line, right? We're studying now the portions about our matriarchs and patriarchs. And what's the storyline? That's pshat. When you delve a little bit deeper, or the example I use of peeling back another layer of the onion, right? You get a little deeper. You have the resh. Resh stands for remez, hint. It's a hint, an allusion to something. Doesn't say it explicitly, but the way it's phrased or the way it's spelled is hinting and alluding to something more. That's resh for remez. Then comes dalid. Dalid is drush. Drush means an expounding of the words, comparing this word to that word and what it has in common, and delving and really taking it even further. And then the last letter, samach, stands for sod. Sod means secrets. Pardes is the expression of the different layers and levels of understanding Torah in its totality. Needless to say, entering into that orchard that has so many different levels and understanding, for people like you and me, we live on the top level, pshat. We have a difficult time even understanding what's the basic. I will never, it is emblazoned on my brain, what my ninth grade Judaic studies teacher, he would stand there in the class, he would ask a question about something in Torah. I'm not even talking about something in one of the prophets later on, or something in one of these way out kind of Judaic literature. He was asking from the five books of Moses. And of course, a bunch of ninth graders, we looked at him like he had horns and had no idea what he was talking about. And he looked at us and he says, "Boys, it's basic Bible. What don't you know?" We live in Shotland. We just Rabbi, I'll be good if I know the story. If I throw out the name Korach, you'll be like, "I know that story." And some of you are scratching your head because you don't know what that story is. But that's pshat. That's just basic level. The Talmud tells a story about four sages, each qualified in their own right as an incredible sage, who entered, so to say, paradise, that kind of understanding. And what happens to them? Well, there's four of them. The first one, his name was Ben-Azai. Ben-Azai. What's his story? Ben-Azai was a tremendous genius, tremendous leader. But what happened to him? Ben-Azai, he was dazzled by the radiant, just the sheer overwhelming illumination of deep insights that he literally, his soul left him and he died. He was exposed. It's the example I'll use is if you know anything about electricity, sometimes you have to put on what's called a resistor. You can't have a direct flow of electricity. It's too much. It's going to overblow the circuits. Ben-Azai, it was too much, and he died. His friend Ben-Zoma, what happened to him? Well, Ben-Zoma looked, he became completely confused. He thought he knew all this stuff, and they threw out information to him. He couldn't process, and the way the Talmud phrases it, he got lost in the labyrinth. He got lost in the maze, couldn't work his way out. He got mentally confused. What? This doesn't make sense. This doesn't jive. And he went Meshuggah. One other fellow, which we don't even call him by name anymore because he became an agnostic. He became a heretic and blew off Judaism. We don't even refer to him by name. We call him Acher. Acher means the other one. He was so turned upside down, he didn't know Judaism from Christianity or Islam, and he literally threw away his religion. There's only one sage that went in and came out okay, Rabbi Akiva. The great Rabbi Akiva, He's the only one who was careful not to overstep the bounds, and somehow he managed to leave unharmed with a greater and deeper appreciation. I share this with you so you understand that there are certain concepts that are just so difficult. I make a point that when I teach the Chumash, when I teach the five books of Moses, I don't start as the Torah starts in the beginning. I don't start with chapter one or two. For people who are first learning Torah, yeah, I can tell the basic storyline, but to read through it and try to understand it, it's almost impossible. I don't fully understand it, and I'm a little bit further ahead than you. Just one class. That's how I stay ahead. Okay? So I start with Cain and Abel. That's easy. Sibling rivalry, murder, we can relate to that. That's easy. Okay, but once you understand this concept, so you'll understand, therefore, that the two mems represent the openly revealed aspect of God's actions, and the closed mem more represents the hidden, the concealed aspect of godliness in our world. Okay? The entire body of Mishnah, interestingly enough, starts with the word me'ematai, which is the open mem, and the very last word actually ends, its last letter is the closed mem. Starts with that mem and ends with the mem. Why is that? Because the truth of the matter is that when we start learning, and I think if we're honest with ourselves, it's true with almost every subject we start to learn. When we begin, we expect the knowledge to come easily, should be easily accessible. I'm a smart guy. Just teach me what I need to know. Shouldn't be so difficult. But if you truly have done a good job in whatever discipline you enjoy learning about, the more you learn, the more you realize how little you know and how much more there is. And what you thought was so easily accessible becomes, whoa, this is far deeper than I thought it was. Oh, I see that there's perhaps, when we talk about Torah, an infinite wisdom that's unrevealed to mankind. One of the great sages of the Hasidic dynasty said that the goal in life, or the goal when one is studying their Judaism and Torah, is for one to know that he does not know. That's the goal. And the more you delve into the open mem, what you think is so accessible, as you go through the entire order of Mishnah or any other aspect, you end up at the closed mem, realizing whatever I know is not even a drop in the bucket to what really it is. Okay? Therefore, the Talmud does not start on page one. Did you know that? The Talmud starts on page two. No, not because the printers decided to print an extra blank page like the bank statements. They go ahead. It purposely starts on page two. Why? Because if it starts on page one, one might think that you have mastered it all. I went from one to the end. I got this. No, we start officially on Daf Bet, page two, because there's always something you didn't get. There's always more. It's infinite. Let's look at this letter mem one more time, the open mem. It's really fascinating because what you find, as we've done with other letters, the letter mem here is comprised of two letters. You have this letter that looks like the chaf right over here, right? That looks similar to this letter. And then you have, let's use blue, then you have this letter, which looks very similar to this letter, the letter Vav. You have a Chaf and a Vav. In fact, that's how a sofer, a scribe who's writing a Torah, actually writes it. He writes it first as a Chaf and then adds the connecting Vav to it. Hey guys, guess what? Chaf, we discussed already. This is a cumulative test. You need to remember every golden word. The chaf was what number?
20.
And the vav?
10.
Nope.
Six.
20 plus 6 is 26. Does that sound familiar to anybody? 26. Come on, it's the number we refer to over and over and over again.
Tetragrammaton.
Yes, that is God's name. God's name is 26, the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He. So here it is, the Mem, which is now representing both aspects of the open and closed, the aspect of hidden, concealed, yet accessible and open, has the same numerical value, or at least alludes to the Chaf and the Vav, which is the name of mercy. We've discussed this a few times, where the Yud and the He and the Vav and the He is the name we associate most with God's attribute of mercy. Both the revealed and the concealed are essentially all mercy, even the concealed. We talked about this when we spoke a few times about this concept of where the hidden goodness in the letter Tet, Tov, sometimes we don't see it, but we know that there is a goodness in there. We refer to in English as the silver lining, but the truth is that we always recognize that if it comes from God, it has an ultimate good purpose. Is it not challenging? Sure, it's challenging. Might it be difficult? Yes. Is there a level of suffering? Yes. But was it for a good reason? Yes. I personally can't answer all the whys, but we believe that there is. So this Mem, which represents the concealed and the open, has that aspect of mercy, that name of mercy, that 26. Similar to what we talked about with Shema. You know, Shema, what do we say? Shema Yisrael, listen, O Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, right? Hashem, we spell Yud and a Hey and Vav and Hey. And then we say Elokeinu, that he's our God. But that's the other name that we use. That's the name of strict justice. Well, make up your mind, Jews. Is it Yudke Vavke? Is it the God of mercy? Or is it Elokim, Elokeinu, God of strict justice? Make up your mind. Well, we finish the sentence by saying Hashem Echad. It's all one. It's one God. And it ultimately is all for mercy. This is what's alluded to immediately when we talk about the Mem, as essentially the two Mems have to go together. That's what the Talmud is teaching us. Has to be with an open and a closed. Those two work hand in hand. Perhaps that's the reason. If you've ever been, unfortunately, to a Shiva house or to somebody who's sitting in mourning, we wish them comfort. There's a classic expression that we say, Hamakom yenachem etchem, God, right? That's the word we use for God. Hamakom literally means the place. Hamakom, God, should comfort you among all the mourners of Zion and Israel. You're familiar with that, right? But why of all times and all places do we change the word for God and we call him Hamakom, the place? That's not his name. Last I checked, it was Yudke Vavke. Why now all of a sudden do we call him Makom? Question number one. Question number two, Jay's already thinking about this because I know he's going to chat it to me. There's another time that you're all familiar when we use that same word for God, Hamakom. When else? You all know it. Don't be shy. You know where the mute button is. Come on. Would you like a hint?
Yes.
Think of your Passover Seder. You guys know what that is, right? Okay. Whew. Okay. Because then we're going to have to stop right here on the letter Mem and go back to the basics of Aleph, right? Where we say, Baruch HaMakom Baruch Hu, blessed is God, blessed be his name. And then we talk about the four sons. But again, we refer to God by the name Makom. Why? Folks, how do you spell the word Makom? Starts with the open Mem, Ma, and it ends with the closed Mem. The name Makom is the name that we use for number one, that it's perceived through the wonders of the function of the universe. That's the open mem, where it's so obvious. Just open your eyes to see God in the wondrous world that he created. But yet it ends with the closed mem, because in truth, he remains unknowable, hidden beyond human grasp and total understanding. Therefore, when we come to situations where we don't understand, we can't see it. I thought this was my perspective. This was my perception of God. But now this happened. I don't understand God. Why did he die? Why did she pass away at this point? And now I have questions. Yeah, it's at that moment we call him Makom. We call him the place, because it starts with the open mem and ends with the closed mem. When we console a mourner, when we're trying to view all of Jewish history at the Seder, we're left with some questions. We don't fully understand. Why do we have to go through the hard times as a people? Why have there been pogroms? Why was there a Holocaust? I don't know the answer, folks. But when we are faced with that challenge, we remind ourselves, Makom, certain aspects we do understand, the open mem, openness, but there are some aspects that are difficult for us to humanly understand, hard to comprehend. It ends with the closed mem. Specifically in those situations, we are grappling with trying to understand the bigger picture. That's when we use this name Makom to talk about traversing from the open to the closed. It's not surprising, therefore, that all of Jewish history has this pattern of exile, redemption, exile, redemption. We keep going from what we think we understand, why we got back the land of Israel, and then we're kicked out. We got the temple, then it was destroyed. And then we got it back, and it was destroyed. And now we keep going up and back, up and back. What was the first exile that we had as a people? Which country?
Egypt.
Egypt. What's Egypt in Hebrew, folks? Mitzrayim. Hey, guess what? Looky here. Starts with the open mem and it ends with the closed mem. Why? Because at first it was an open, warm, welcoming country. Welcomed Joseph's family with open arms. Couldn't wait to have more of Joseph's in the land. Everything was great. And then by the time the whole exile was coming to an end, we had become enslaved with the harshest of all labors. And we didn't understand. How did we go from open mem to closed mem? And what's in the middle of the name Mitzrayim? You have the word tsar. Well, some of you are thinking tsar is pain, but that's spelled differently. Tsar in Hebrew means narrow, tight, compressed area, a compressed state, a narrow strait. We went from an openness and got squished down to the closed mem, because that was the prototype of what the Jewish history was going to be revealing and playing out over the next few thousand years that we are still in the process of. That is part one. Part one is understanding that the letter mem represents open and concealed. But there's a second part, because the Talmud tells us that the word that is most associated with the letter mem and what it really represents is the word mayim. Mayim means water. You say to me, okay, I can live with that. But how does that fit the same paradigm you just told me about starting? Because the word mayim is spelled open mem, yud, closed mem. Okay, how does water fit this pattern now? Well, let's go back to the very first introduction that we had about water in our world. If you recall, day one of creation, there's nothingness. God says, let there be light. So there's light and there's darkness. And then on day two, all of a sudden we're told that God splits the waters, the upper waters and the lower waters. God divided it. Well, the lower waters, that's pretty open. We can see that. That's our oceans, our lakes, our rivers, our streams, and even somewhat of the subterranean, if you want. The upper waters, That is completely closed. It's way out there, and we don't even know how it all works. Water really represents the accessible and the inaccessible aspects of connecting to God. But let's try to understand that a little more. On the holiday of Sukkot, I know that some of you were at Shoresh a few Simchas Torahs ago, and I spoke about this water everywhere. Such a fascinating concept. To this day, we still celebrate in the middle of the Sukkot holiday. We know that the classic symbols are the sukkah and the lulav and etrog and the four species that we take. But there's something that's not as well known. And it's somewhat, I would say, celebrated in some of areas of the Jewish community around the world. It's called the Simchat Beit HaShoeva. Literally means the celebration about the drawing up. Drawing, as in a bucket, drawing up from a well. And they celebrated. What was the celebration? So in the time of the temple, they used to have a very special event on the holiday of Sukkot. They would take a pitcher of water, a certain amount of water, and they would pour it on the side of the altar, of the Mizbeach. There were two holes, two drains that led down to an underground water source that ran under the temple. After Corona, God willing, we're going to go on an Israel trip. We'll take you all the archaeology. We'll show you all this stuff. It's amazing. Okay? But you have, what's so significant that they would have this water libation? Because every day of the year when they brought offerings, they had, in conjunction with the offering, they had a wine libation. Comes the holiday of Sukkot, we make a big deal, and we have water. Interesting. What exactly is it? So, again, without getting into too much detail, what are these two drains that connect down below? What is it that we're trying to do here? So, again, those two holes in the side of the Mizbeach, each one is called a shis, shin yud tav, shis. Shisin or shitin, if you want to put it in plural, okay? What are so special about these drains? In fact, the very first word in the Torah is bereshit, right? If you break it into two words, bara, he created shis, the drain. Already from the beginning of creation, something about this drain, about connecting with it, had something very significant. Very quickly. So we just said that at first the world was covered with water, okay? It's the source of all life. In philosophical or Kabbalistic terms, that water being the source of life represents the endless supply, the endless source of God's kindness and goodness, right? Because if it's water everywhere, it's unlimited, it's infinite. That represents chesed, that kindness that never ends. On day two, God split that and put a space between the upper waters and the lower waters. And on day three, God gathered the lower waters to allow the dry land to appear. So if you need to refresh your memory, it's chapter one. Pretty simple, okay? In fact, now, what you have is the heavens, we'll call Shamayim, right? The heavens act as the lowest level of the upper level. That's what separates us from the upper waters. And the ground, the land, is the highest level of that which is the lower waters. You follow that? I don't want to lose you here. You don't follow that. You have a space. You have all water, and then you split it, right? Now you have a space. So the upper waters are contained with a barrier called the heavens, and the lower waters are contained with a barrier on top of it called the earth, the land. Okay? That's what you have in the middle. Well, how do you connect? Is there any way for us to connect to that endless supply of God's goodness? Well, we have to somehow connect back to that water. Well, thankfully, God does us a favor. Rain from above, right? When it rains, we get droplets that come down, so to say, from heaven. And why do we connect with the lower waters? That's what this celebration on Sukkot was. It was a way of connecting when we poured the water. Where did we get the water from? We drew it up from a spring, a natural spring that comes from below. We would draw it up and then we would pour it on the Mizbeach, on the altar. What was the point of it? Is because what we want to do is we want to be able to connect through this medium of water to that godliness of both open and concealed. That's really the two parts that go with it. In fact, you all heard of the prophet Jonah? You know that story, Jonah and that big fish? Great. Mm-hmm. Where did he get his divine inspiration about this command to go to the city of Nineveh and to warn them? And the Talmud says that he got it at that party, the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, that celebration in the temple. And it makes a play on words. I told you that the word Shoeva means to draw up, and it's referring to the water. Oh, but the Talmud is not satisfied because that's got to be symbolic of something more. The drawing up of the water means the drawing up of the source of life, the drawing up of that connection to the ultimate source of life, godliness. You know what was drawn up at that celebration? Divine inspiration. Jonah got his first command, his first prophecy at that celebration. He was able to draw up from that connection with that water. So what do you have? So we have this water concept, but let's see one more piece to it. We'll bring it all together and then we'll take some questions. If you look there are certain aspects of water in our world that have a flow, like streams, springs. They're not stagnant. They continuously flow. That's very reminiscent of the open mem that has that open area for water to flow. But there are other bodies of water that are closed, like oceans, lakes, ponds. They're not necessarily flowing. It's a closed area. So when you look at the word mayim, water, you have the open mem representing the running bodies of water. And you have at the other end, the closed mem representing the closed bodies of water. But what's in the middle? What's in the middle is that little yud, right? Mem, yud, mem. That's how it's spelled. Has the yud, the individual droplet of water. What is that? What connects that? What is that droplet of water? What would it possibly represent? Could it be the connecting point between the two? Maybe. There are those that suggest it. But it also might be that letter that represents the pipeline of connection. Why do I say that? I alluded to it earlier, but I didn't focus on it. And I apologize if I'm not as clear as I should be. What letter is this? This is the letter Mem. And in the course, when you count them out, it's the 13th letter. Okay? The number 13 is pivotal in Judaism. The 13th letter. First of all, the number 13, there are 13 channels. You'll have to trust me on this. There are 13 channels of God's infinite flow to our world, from the infinite to the finite. There are 13 such channels, okay? It's not for now, but that's the idea of the 12 months, and then sometimes you have the extra month, the second Adar is a 13th month. There are 13. The number 13 is very, very, very often used as that channel of that flow of godliness down to our world. It's not surprising, therefore, that the word for love in Hebrew is ahava, has the numerical value of 13. Because on so many levels, you have a spouse, two spouses, their love for each other is creating a flow of energy, hopefully positive. It's a positive flow of energy. But also it represents even a flow from godliness down to our world, from the infinite to the finite. Why does God do that? Out of love. love is a whole concept. Maybe we'll talk about that. But that's really what it is. It flows like water down these channels. 13th letter, 13 channels of the flow. There are also, we just got through not that long ago, the high holiday season. We asked over and over and over and over again, God, grant us a year of life. Grant us a year of health. Grant us a year of success. And we kept going back to the blank attributes of mercy. The, yes, 13 attributes of mercy. Why 13? That's such a seemingly random number, but it's not. Because that's what this number 13 represents. It represents that flow of goodness, of the ability to connect from the infinite to the finite. The similarity of water flowing through a channel is God's goodness and mercy flowing to us when we ask for it. All of that having to do with the number 13. I'm going to stop here. There's another part which we will explore next week, God willing, that we'll take this and we'll review. I know it's a hard concept. But we're gonna take it and see that this really ties into two more aspects. One is the aspect of Torah, right? Because again, we're always talking about openness and closed. We talked about that the letters mem mean there are certain passages and understandings that are open and certain. So we got to talk about how Torah fits into this. And then we got to tie in the number 40 into all of this. Okay? Let me open up to questions. So feel free to ask for clarification. This was not a simple one. Great. No questions. Fabulous.
Comment that 13 is also the age of a bar mitzvah. So that makes sense that he's going into that next level.
Good. So that concept of transitioning, we're going to see. Yes, very much so. Once you understand that there's a flow and a maturity as you move along from the easily accessible as you go further in, it becomes deeper and deeper. Yes, that is the concept of maturing. Yes.
This is sort of related, but just going back to the story of the four stages, they were trying to enter into what? I wasn't sure where they were trying to enter and what they were having problems. That was my problem.
This is a perfect example of where concepts are difficult to wrap our heads around.
Sometimes.
The term is called pardes. Right. Literally, it means an orchard and it means a paradise.
Okay.
But I don't believe for one moment that we're talking about a physical place that they were entering into.
Right.
We're talking about conceptually of where entering into something means you are all in, like in poker. You are all in. I dabble in it. You and I try to share some concepts. We put our toe in the pool every now and then. Maybe. These sages went into the orchard. They went into paradise, hook, line, and sinker. They tried to comprehend the vast totality of the open and the hidden on all the different levels.
Looking at the spiritual part of the Torah, is that what we're talking about, we think?
Everything.
Everything.
I'm talking about not just, again, Torah. What is Torah, Robin? Torah is the expressed will of God.
Gotcha.
Okay. So how many times have you heard me say, I'm not God, I don't really understand? Have you heard me say that before?
Yes,
because that's who I am. I don't know. I'm not God. If I were mastering Torah, and I mean mastering it from A to Z, everything, I still wouldn't come up to the toenails of these sages.
Gotcha. Okay.
And they who mastered the complete understanding that is humanly possible, they entered into that orchard to get to the next level.
Right.
And only one of them made it out unscathed.
Okay. That makes more sense to me.
That's how difficult. That's not a fair word. It's not difficult. That's how challenging for a human brain to understand. Because you're asking a finite brain to comprehend, to some degree, infinity. These are all shaking our head because we understand it conceptually, but we have no idea what we're talking about.
Right.
That's how far removed. Sages who mastered it to such an unbelievable degree that we study their teachings to this day. Three of them went way off. Couldn't handle it. That's the closed mouth. But it's part of our life.
Well, that makes more sense, because that concept I was having a problem with when you were saying the orchard and the paradise. So thank you.
That's really what it is.
Just any other words in the Torah besides Mayim and Mitzrayim, which have this open and closed at the beginning of the words, that off the top of your head that you can think of?
Until you said off the top of my head, I was going to say yes.
Miriam.
There's probably a ton of them.
Okay, I just thought maybe you had some more that you could just recall.
Yeah,
we're
going to do the pin test. Random open up to a page. Of course, now we won't find one.
Oh. You said that, Jay.
Good job. Yeah, Jay, say it.
Yeah.
Oh, Miriam, there you go.
Miriam.
Okay.
Miriam. That's good. We'd have to understand why.
Yeah.
Let's try to understand that. I didn't think about it, but now that you mention it, it wouldn't surprise me. Miriam, when we're first introduced to her, right? How are we introduced to her?
At the river, at the Nile. Right.
Yeah, I think it's even before that.
When Moses was born.
When she said about for the children, having for another brother, is that it? But, no, in the beginning, as far as the midwife,
there you go. She's not even called by her name at first. Miriam and Yocheved. Miriam, the daughter, Yocheved, the mother. They're known as Shifra and Pua. Hidden. Before you even get to know her, you already have that hidden mem. Mm-hmm. But you get to learn about her. And in fact, Miriam is the matriarch that ultimately is the antecedent, like that, huh? Of whom? King David, who ultimately is the antecedent of Mashiach, the Messiah. It runs the entire gamut. I have it down on the list to try and get it in. I don't know if I'll get to it, but tying in Moshe and Mashiach into this as well fits as well. So maybe we'll get to it next week. But I venture to say, I can't say for sure, and I'm not promising that every single word that starts with the mem and ends with the mem is fits the paradigm. But it's clear from that piece of Talmud that that's the essential nature of the letter.
That'd be an interesting study.
Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. You have your homework.
Report back in a week, please. Thanks.
There you go.
I was supposed to report something back from last week, but I can't remember now.
Good job, Robin.
Sorry.
Works for me.
No, sorry, I'll look and try to find it.
I'll have to listen to the tape.
I know. Sorry.
All right. Fabulous. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
We'll see you.
Have a great week, everyone.